Okay, Rav Moshe Feinstein, or Rav Moshe, depends who you ask. Really unbelievable, fascinating character. I'm sure everyone already knows a lot about him, but we'll give you a little bit more context, a little bit more details, and some good stories. Rav Moshe is known for his character, and especially once it's in the 21st century, or the 20th century, that he's living, we have a lot of stories, because there's a lot of documentation. I just watched yesterday, I was part of facilitating a discussion for this film at the Holocaust Center, Operation Finale. And in one scene over there, he's talking to the group that's going in, preparing to go get Eichmann. And I think it's David Ben-Gurion that says to them, he says to them, you know, history... Oh, you were there, Sarita.
Yes.
He says something like... History is documented by the people that hold the pen, or something like that. And he says to them, like, you're holding the pen, right? And it's specifically, or history is remembered by those who can document it, basically. Because there are a lot of things from a long time ago that we don't really know about. We don't know a lot of stories about, we don't have a lot of stories about Rashi. We have legends about Rashi. We don't have a lot of stories about, different fundamental characters of Jewish history. But people from the 20th century have a lot of stories about, because we had documentation, we had people that could write, we had people that could, record things in different ways, and therefore we have a lot of wonderful stories about Rav Moshe. So the truth is, even though Rav Moshe was, a grand, master that we all know in America, he actually, he gets his career started in... There's another paper over here, Eddie, if you want to, in the middle of the table, there's one extra. He gets his career really started in Europe. He's born in 1895 in Belarus, and he's actually born on a very auspicious day. He's born on the 7th of Adar. Anyone know what the 7th of Adar is?
Yeah.
Moshe Rabbeinu's birthday and Yahrzeit, right? That's happening this week from tomorrow night. either way, tonight is Rosh Chodesh, which is why we're talking about this, Rosh Chodesh Adar. And Rav Moshe's father, that he was born into two prestigious families, his father's family and his mother's family. His father was the Rav of a place called Uzdan in Belarus, near Minsk. His father was a great grandson of the Vilna Gaon's brother.
Whoa.
So I guess like first cousin four times removed. Of the Vilna Gaon, but he was born. That's his father's family, and his mother's family, Vega Gittel, came from a prestigious rebbe in, I think, Prague, named Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller. So I don't know if Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, the Tos was Yom Tov. He may or may not be. He may or may not be famous based on a Rav Shlomo Karlbach story that you might not even know is about him, because Rav Shlomo doesn't mention it. But there's a famous story from Rav Shlomo about Yasala the Holy Miser. Anyone know that story? Yasala, who always would bring the poor people into his house, and he would kick them out before he actually gave them any money. How dare you come and think you're going to make any money here? I work hard for my money. You don't deserve any of my money. And then he would anonymously send them money some other way. So there's this... There's this tombstone, in Prague, that has Yostala Kamsen HaKadosh, the Holy Miser. And Rav Shlomo has a whole story about it. And we still have the gravestone. We can't make the words out. But they say this is the gravestone. And Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller was the Rav who got the message after Yostala died. They say that Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller was the Rav who Yostala came to in a dream and told him, don't worry, this is how I wanted it to be. Because they didn't bury him, his whole story. You have to listen to it. It's an unbelievable story. Either way, there's a follow-up story that Rav Shlomo talks about, how when he told the story once, there's a guy in the crowd who revealed, who was a cardinal, like Catholic, like bishop or something, revealed to Rav Shlomo that he was a descendant of Yasla the Holy Miser, and his name was Joseph, and then he became Frum, whatever. It's like a whole crazy story. But either way, that's Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller. He's should be more famous because of his parish on Mishnah, called the Tosfos Yom Tov. But either way, this was one of the ancestors of Rav Moshe's mother, and he himself was a descendant of the Shla, the Shnei Luchos HaBris, who himself traces himself back to Rashi, which, you know, is, you know, obviously very prominent. There are a lot of Ashkenazi Jews that come from Rashi. Many Ashkenazi Jews can trace themselves back to Rashi's family one way or another. Either way, that's where he comes from. So two prominent rabbinic families. But he obviously had to do the work himself. He's not just going to be put on a pedestal right away. When he is 8 years old, there's a story that said, one of these legends about Rav Moshe, again, because it's the 20th century, at this point it is the 20th century, in 1903, they say that one time he was playing chess with a friend of his, and it was a very serious game, and eventually, you know, they get through the game, and he clearly showed his prowess as a chess player, and Rav Moshe said to himself, you know, this is a wonderful game, it's really honing my intellect, but I shouldn't be using it on chess. I should be using it on Torah. The legend goes that he never played chess again, and he only learned Torah. That's the legend. I don't know what the lesson is from that story, but that's the legend, they say. Another thing that they say, this apparently Rav Moshe said, if anyone has ever seen Rav Moshe in a picture, you have some pictures here, but none of them are really standing. You can see him actually here in the first picture on the top left. I think that's Menachem Begin, and you can see Rav Moshe looks even small next to Menachem Begin. So if he looks small next to Menachem Begin, he's definitely small, just in general. I think they say he wasn't much more than 5 feet tall, if that. So he was very short. And even in school, he was apparently very, very short. And he says that apparently when he was younger, he never liked to play sports. He never liked to play ball in the yard because he was always so short. It was always too intimidating. So instead, he just learned. And Baruch Hashem, he made that decision. Either way, they say that by the age of 16, he had learned all of Shas, and he had finished the Shulchan Aruch. The problem, however, was that he was being called to the Russian army. And in those days, the Russian army was not just one of these little stints that you get for 3-4 years. This was something really changed your entire life. Like you were brought into the Tsar's army, and then that was it. So he goes to none other than the Chafetz Chaim, who was very instrumental in getting many Talmidim out of the Russian army. And it so happens that he was put on a list, but he was never actually, you know, what's it called, conscripted? Is that the term?
Yeah.
He was never actually brought in yet. But by the time that he would even be of age that they would want him, he had become a Rav already of a shul, and that apparently got him off. At that time in Russia, that was good enough to get you off the list. So that happens already in his later teen years. So who did he learn with? He studied with his father, obviously. He learned all of Chumash and a couple of the of Staros of Shas, a lot of Gemara, already by his bar mitzvah. Apparently, the story has it, actually, that he had his father, David Feinstein, who was the Rav, again, in Uzdan, where they were. So he actually had hired a Rebbe for him. Now, the problem that Rav David had with the Rebbe was the Rebbe had 10 Talmidim in the class, and he wanted Rav Moshe, at that point, Moshe, he wanted him to get more attention. So Rav David actually paid 6 students' worth of tuition so that he could only have a 5-person class instead of a 10-person class. I don't know. That's how the story goes. Pretty big commitment that we should all learn from. But before he's even married, and this is something which even in America is rare, but is as you can imagine in Europe was even more rare. Rav Moshe became a Rav of a shul before he was ever married. Very rarely do you find a Rav in America who's single. If you do, it's often in a very small place, which doesn't have a lot of responsibilities, or he's an outstanding Rav. So Rav Moshe was already outstanding while he was already a teenager, and he becomes a Rav of a place in Russia called Luban while he was still single. The story goes, this is one of these stories of Rav Moshe, again, that as you might imagine, Rav Moshe couldn't cook. He wasn't much of a food preparer, and he had other women in the community make him food. Apparently, I don't know how we know these things. You know, that's always the kasha in a lot of these stories. Apparently, the food was never good, and the women weren't good cooks. But Rav Moshe ate it anyway. That's what they say about Rav Moshe when he was still single in Luban. Ultimately, he marries a woman named Shima Kustanovich.
Find out that the food was no good.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know
how.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know who told him. Maybe other people in the community always ate the food, and they decided it wasn't good. Yeah, exactly. So he marries Shima Kustanovich at the age of 25. He was learning until he was 25. He was learning after that, obviously, also. But he didn't get married until he was 25, which is different from other gedolim who were married earlier than that. But with Shima, I don't know, is Shima or Sima?
Shima.
Is it Shima?
I don't know, but the Shima is
It is a real name.
It's a real name.
Yeah, I know the Sima. I know more Simas than I know Shimas.
We have a Meir Shima.
Okay, very nice. So. They ultimately have six children together, five of whom were born in Europe. The Bechor, Pesach Chaim, actually passed away in Europe. I'm not really sure of the details of that. They then had two daughters, Fega Gittel. Might be getting confused there. Oh, I guess he named her after his mother. I guess his mother had passed away before she was born. She marries a Rav named Rav Moshe Shiskal. And his daughter Shifra marries a Rav people might be familiar with named Rav Moshe Tendler. Sifra was her name? Okay, I thought it was Shifra. So Rav Moshe Tendler, he's a Rosh Yeshiva at YU, I think, still, and he's a Rav in Muncie. He's been there for a long time. I know someone who's at his shul. He then has a son, David Feinstein, named after his father, who ultimately succeeds Rav Moshe as the Rosh Yeshiva in Manhattan. And then when he's in America, he has his last child, Reuven Feinstein, who opened up the Yeshiva branch in Staten Island, which he's known by. Either way, when he's, so he spends, 16 years in Europe, and ultimately he notices in 1936 that, things aren't going well for the Jews in Russia, and through some familial connections in America, and other apparently political favors that he had cashed in on, he was able to get to America in either 1936 or 1937, and he settled. He actually first went to go to Cleveland. There's apparently a yeshiva in Cleveland at the time, but the Rosh Yeshiva passed away within the first few months of him getting there, and the yeshiva closed down because of it. So he ends up moving to Manhattan into the Lower East Side. And he joins the yeshiva called Tiferes Yerushalayim, which at the time was, substantial. It was around for, 15 years or so. But obviously once Rav Moshe got hold of it, and he grew up he grew into the position, so it became a well-known and very prominent yeshiva. It probably helped that the Lower East Side in 1937 was destined to blow up in terms of population and all of the Jewish population that was there, as opposed to Cleveland, which still, never really increased at that time, at least. So he was at the Tiferes Yerushalayim in Lower East Side. And he becomes a regular Rosh Yeshiva there. One thing leads to another. He starts to answer a couple Talmidim Shilas. And those Shilas, get around. And other Rabbanim from town start to ask him Shilas. And more Rabbanim from around America start to ask him shilas, and one thing leads to another. Rav Moshe is ultimately answering shilas from people all over the world, as we know about him. When he was the Rosh Yeshiva, while he was the Rosh Yeshiva at Tiferes Yerushalayim, so he gave a daily shir, and his daily shirim are recorded in his in a sefer that he calls Dibros Moshe, which I think we have about 14 mesechtas of. We don't have one here. We don't have a lot of achronim.
Oh, we did.
But he has a commentary on Shas based on his shirim at the yeshiva. But he's more well known for obviously, and maybe not obviously to some people who don't know, is Igros Moshe. Right. This is this is Rav Moshe's big sefer. This is what he becomes known for. This is a collection of all of the responsa that he gives to different rabbanim in America and across the world. We typically look at this sefer as, or at least I look at this sefer, I can't speak for others, as really the building blocks of American Judaism, because shilas that come up in the Sefer oftentimes have to do with, you know, the culture of America, things that are going on either economically or socially, culturally, and things, for instance, that we have a very prime example of in our shul with this mechitza, you know, built upon many of the statements of Rav Moshe when he's dealing with mechitzas, and things like, you know, working on Shabbos, not working on Shabbos, things like milk, right? People are familiar with the fact that, you know, most milks nowadays, at least that you would find in a supermarket in America, are made by non-Jews. And technically the Gemara tells us that there is concern for milk made by non-Jews. So Rav Moshe was of the opinion, which became the standard psak of America, that milk made by non-Jews even in America is allowed because the FDA standards are even higher than the halachic standards. And therefore, you don't have to be worried about the milk that you can find in a regular supermarket. And therefore, there are many people, especially in our community, that follow that the opinion that you can use chalav stam, as they call it. It's not even, people don't even think about it because of Rav Moshe. People never even think twice about milk. Sometimes you'll think twice if it doesn't have a hechsher on it. But hechsherim are very easy on milk because there's not much they can mess up. But either way, he has other shalas that come up, specifically about America, which really form, you know, the standard practice of America. And if you think about when he came to America in the 1930s, so there weren't that many gedolim in America. Who was in America? So you have Rav Aaron Cutler in Lakewood, who was really only getting started. He's not even... In the 1930s, he wasn't there yet. Right. But he was sort of, when Rav Moshe was coming up as the Gadol Hador, right? Rav Moshe only comes out with his first Igros Moshe, meaning the first compilation of his tshuvas in about 1950, in the 1950s, I forget what year in the 1950s. But at that time, he wasn't a Gadol even, right?
But Rav Moshe was one who shared with Aaron to come here.
Yeah, he helped. I mean, but Rav Aaron...
And Rav Moshe said he has to come here. It's a desert here.
Right. So meaning there weren't that many other notable rabbanim. I don't exactly know the details of Aaron coming over to America.
When was Rabbi Soloveitchik?
Rabbi Soloveitchik was later. I don't know the exact dates, but I don't have another paper. But Rav Moshe was basically, you know, making a name for himself. When he comes over, he's only, you know, 42 years old. So he wasn't as prominent as some of the other rabbanim. But once he gets his tshuvas out there, he becomes much more prominent. He was involved in many American sort of societies for rabbanim and for Judaism. For instance, he was the president of the Vad HaRabbanim, which is sort of like the OU, but more Haredi. It was created in response to JTS, but whatever, we don't have to get into that. He also chaired the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah of Agudas Yisrael. He was involved even for the Haredi chinuch system in Eretz Yisrael. He was instrumental in creating the curriculum there, or at least the school system. And he became basically the leading gadol in America. He was also involved in, you know, medical ethics issues for Judaism. We heard a little bit about that from Yael Weil on Shabbos. But he got, obviously, questions from all over. And there's still, by the way, there's still some volumes of the Igros Moshe that have not yet printed. Some people think that they shouldn't be printed, because if Moshe never published them, that means he didn't want them out. But there was one that came out probably about 10 years ago, the ninth chelek of... we don't even have it. we have an older version, two older versions. But there is a ninth chelek. I have it at home, and I've personally read other tshuvas from the non-existent tenth chelek. And the question is whether it's ever going to be published, because there are many things even in Igros Moshe where Rav Moshe is talking to an American, you know, an American cultural Jewish society, which is not necessarily the ideal halacha. So many of his tshuvas are given to individuals, not for the masses. So the fact that Rav Moshe didn't publish them is possibly for good reason, because he didn't want it to go to the masses, because he wanted it specifically to certain people. And there are some nowadays who also respond to Rav Moshe's tshuvas and saying he was speaking to a different world. You know, he was speaking to Jews in the 50s or the 60s, where you know there was other issues that he might not be lenient about nowadays. Yeah.
That could be true, but then you can say the same thing about anybody, say Rambam or.
Yeah, you can always say that about a different Rav. The difference here is that Rav Moshe, when he came to America, is coming to a place which was notably irreligious. And therefore, he might have been using... And you could say that there are parts of Spain that were irreligious with the Rambam. You could say those types of things. We wouldn't know necessarily historically the accuracy of it, but we do know for sure that Rav Moshe was speaking to a vastly less religious American Judaism Jewry than was back in Europe. So it's unclear and it's very hard to determine, but the fact that Rav Moshe published the tshuvas gives us a little bit more a little more security to rely on them, right? Because we do know for sure that there were tshuvas he didn't publish, right? Many personal letters that he didn't put in his responses, he didn't want people to know. So those we know he wouldn't want to the masses. So there's some now that he wrote later in life that never made it to the book. And the question is, would he have put them in or not? And we don't actually know. So that's why.
How would you as a Rav, not that I should look at it,
yeah,
but you're going to be contacting people who are at that level. How
yeah.
are you going to learn his wisdom?
If I don't have them?
If you don't have them.
Yeah, so sometimes I'm able to get them. Sons have access to them, obviously. And they look, I've seen them inside. They look just like the inside of the book that we have. It's just never been actually published, probably partly because of this reason. So they're accessible for Rabbanim if they need them. I don't have immediate access to them, but if I need to, I can. I can find things. But yeah, you're right. We're at a loss for more Rav Moshe tshuvas. But just a note about Rav Moshe's tshuvas, which are very unique in some ways because of how they differ from previous Rabbanim Gedolim's tshuvas. And some were actually opposed to his tshuvas because of this. Apparently the Satmar Rebbe was not a big fan of Rav Moshe's tshuvas. I forgot there was another person that also wasn't, but there might have been some hashkafic, not hashkafic against Rav Moshe, but hashkafic in favor of Satmar keeping Satmar. Because what happens basically is, this is really how I should introduce it, Rav Moshe becomes not only the posek for secular Jews in America, right? Rav Moshe becomes the posek for all Jews in America. Whether you're modern Orthodox, whether you're yeshivish, whether you're Hasidish, everyone asks their tshuvas to Rav Moshe, and they ask their tshuvas to Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe becomes basically the center, the headquarter for every psak. Rav Aaron Cutler was around in America in the 70s, and they went to Rav Moshe for the psak. Everyone went to Rav Moshe. And the Satmar Rebbe apparently was very opposed to one specific tshuva, but it might have been representative of his general approach to Rav Moshe in general, because he was afraid of losing Satmar Hasidim from his community. That's what I heard from somebody, but I can't tell you. I'm not at that caliber of historian to understand the inner workings of that relationship. But what we do know is Rav Moshe was by far the address for many many Rabbanim across America.
With questions. So was he himself documenting the answers or someone?
Yeah, he himself, for the majority of them, I think he himself was documenting. I heard for sure the first one, he kept scrupulous notes of everything he wrote. He writes in the introduction to the Igros Moshe, he thinks like, he says something, and everyone who knows stories about Rav Moshe knows about his humility. He says, I'm torn, because on the one hand, I'm not supposed to write tshuvas if I don't think I'm, the requisite, a person to answer. But at the same time, everybody keeps asking me questions. So if they think I am, so then I have to write them down. So he was actually torn. He writes about that in the introduction of the Sefer, that he really doesn't feel, to the level that he should be answering. But what's interesting about Rav Moshe's tshuvas is, despite the fact that he didn't necessarily feel comfortable, he often, or I guess he very rarely quotes Achronim. Now, he'll reference Rav Rona sometimes, but if you, for instance, if you were to open up a tshuva from Rav Avadya Yosef, Rav Avadya Yosef's tshuvas, and I'm not a buck in Rav Avadya's tshuvas, but the few that I've seen, you know, he'll list dozens of achronim. You go over here, you see in this sefer, in that sefer, Rav Moshe doesn't do that. Rav Moshe takes you to the Gemara, and he'll try to understand the Gemara with you, with Rashi and Tosfos, and then he'll try to, you know, maybe he'll include this parish of this Rishon or that Rishon, and then sometimes he'll sprinkle in an Achron to understand the Gemara. But very few times does he quote an Achron in order to determine his Psak. I'm not a Bakin Rav Moshe, so I shouldn't really give, you know, blanket statements like that. But that's a known thing about Rav Moshe's Tshuvas, that if you open them up, he's giving you a Psak based on how he understands the Gemara. And he understands the Gemara with the help of the Rishonim, but he's not giving you a psak because some other Achron in Europe in the 19th century gave a psak like this. Right? He's giving a psak because this is how he understood it, and this is how he understands how to apply it. And the things he's dealing with are modern technology issues that are coming up in America and have never been happening anywhere else in the world. So, for instance, things like artificial insemination. A big tshuva on artificial insemination. Very, very important in allowing such a thing to do. And he said you should specifically use, you know, the insemination from a non-Jew as opposed to for a Jew because it could create possible complications of mamzerus and things like that. Other things like microwave. How do you classify a microwave in halacha? Is there a fire there? Is there not a fire there? Rav Moshe happens to be on a very cutting edge of the technology. He actually gets it a little bit off, but just based on the fact that he doesn't know what it is. It's not even that popular when he's talking about it. So things like that are very instrumental. You know, we talked a few months ago about Ushmartim Eldon Afshosech, and we quoted a tshuva from Rav Moshe in the 60s, before the Inspector General came out with his, before he came out with his report on the effects of smoking. Rav Moshe says over there, it seems like something which would be very dangerous. But how could I disagree with so many gedolim that smoke? If he had seen the Inspector General and see how much it was accepted by modern science, he would have for sure outlawed smoking. I personally have no doubt about that, just knowing, you know, what I know about Rav Moshe. But either way, those are the types of things Rav Moshe had to discern. And he used Gemaras in ways that no one else had ever had to use a Gemara. He applied them in ways that he saw fit, and his Talmidim say he oftentimes did that, wrote the tshuvas without looking at the Gemaras. He just knew the Gemaras. That's what they say. Yeah,
is he comparable to Rambam?
The Rambam doesn't deal with stuff like that.
Didn't have to always provide sources, or he was.
Oh well, in terms day, of that,
he
no,
was a posek.
Yeah, he was definitely the posek, but Rav Moshe doesn't not quote sources. Rav Moshe has tons of sources. He tells you exactly where everything is. The Talmidim just say that he wasn't looking at the literal physical book when he did it. He was quoting where it is, but that's what they say. Some of my favorite Rav Moshe stories. You ready for my favorite Rav Moshe stories? There's so many good ones. Here's one for the women. Apparently the story goes that once Rav Moshe was being honored to speak at some big event, and as we know, Rav Moshe was very humble. He was coming into the auditorium with his wife, and or his wife was at the event, and the Talmidim knew that oftentimes when Rav Moshe came in, he wanted to go, you know, in the back alley, the back channels, so he can come up to the stage as quickly as possible without, you know, making a stir and making everyone stand up for him. And he said to his Talmidim, "I want to go through the main entrance today." So, what do you want to go through the main entrance? You know, don't you always want to go to the back? And in a very modest way, he said, "Yes, but my wife is in the crowd, and I want to give her the nachas that she's married to someone that everyone stands for." And that's what he said, which is unbelievable, just an unbelievable sensitivity that he had. That's one of my favorite stories. Another thing he said, what about Kabbalah? What did Rav Moshe think about Kabbalah? So he used to say, those who talk about it don't know it, and those who know it don't talk about it. A similar statement he said apparently about microphones. This is irrelevant. I think I told you this once, Aviva. He said, people who think you can't use a microphone on Shabbos don't know enough about microphones. And people who think you can use a microphone on Shabbos don't know enough about Shabbos. So exactly what his tshuva was, it's still up for debate. Controversial, but that's what he used to say.
Did you find his
No, I didn't look at it inside, but I've seen parts of it. I've heard people quote it and stuff like that.
The doctor cell phones.
They might have, you know, a lot of it comes down to the same issues that wasn't an innovative thing for Moshe, but a lot of the issues of grumma and kiboy and things like that. Apparently, another story, there was once a Talmud of his whose father had passed away in the middle of the week of his Ufraf. So the boy came to Rav Moshe and said that he asked him what he should do. Because, you know, technically he's in Shiva and you shouldn't really be rejoicing. You're obviously still going to have a wedding, but what are you supposed to do? So Rav Moshe said you should still send flowers to the Kala. So he said, what do you mean? I'm an Avil. I can't send flowers to someone. I can't give a gift. So he says, Avelus at this point is Durabanan, but the busha that you'd cause for your Kala not to have flowers is Duraisa. So you send flowers to a Kala. Another fascinating psak of which includes the sensitivity of Rav Moshe. My great, I don't know if people know my youngest son, his name is Usher. His full name is Usher Gedalia. So the Gedalia part is actually named after my great uncle whose name was Rav Gedalia Einemer. Zatzal, who was a Rav in Silver Spring. And Rav Einemer, when he was younger, came and boarded by Rav Moshe for some time. He was somewhat of a ben bias by him. And Rav Moshe had a thing that I know from my grand uncle that whenever someone would be able to say an entire daf of Gemara Baal Peh, Rav Moshe would give you $1, which in those days was a lot of money, you know. Rav Moshe would give you $1. So my great uncle used to memorize dapim so that he can get home to Cleveland to see his parents, or Akron to see his parents. That's what he used to say. Yeah, Viva.
Yeah. Personal Moshe story?
Yeah, sure.
One summer, we worked at a hotel in the Catskills.
Yeah.
Where the Moshe used to come. Uh-huh. In the summer. And he came, and mm-hmm. He had a big veranda with a big
right.
Family.
Right. Right.
Chairs and families used to put their babies out in the sun to take their nap.
Uh-huh.
And one time, Moshe was walking from the building, walking along the veranda, and one of the babies started crying.
Mm-hmm.
And I was behind him, and he stopped, and he went to the carriage, and he was rocking it, and
yeah.
He said, "Whose baby is this?"
Yeah. Yeah, that's who he was. Apparently, there was another story that I heard that someone told me. I don't think I heard it from my great uncle, but my great uncle said he used to say it at the Siyum for Daf Yomi. He used to say he had a Talmud once who was learned himself, but his father, the Talmud's father, wasn't very learned. And so one time the Talmud went back home and learned a page of Gemara, a Daf of Gemara with his father. And the father said, "I want to make a siyum. It's my first daf ever. I want to make a siyum." So the son, you know, so the Talmud went to Rav Moshe and said, "You know, I know the halacha is you're not supposed to make a siyum unless you finish a whole masechta." Rav Moshe says he can make a siyum, and I want to come. That's what he said. And apparently, this person passed away, and Rav Moshe spoke at the Levaya and told this story. Either way, so a lot of great stories. Here's another one that I have here on the. On the handout that I have, this was printed in the Jewish Week, and this is I've heard this story a lot of times from different people, probably because it was popularized in this article. One summer, I was spending. This is from a rabbi, a doctor, Isaac Stephen Hirschkoff, psychiatrist at NYU Medical Center. One summer, I was spending a week with my aunt and uncle in upstate Ellenville. Okay, Rav Moshe used to go to upstate a lot. Uncle David and Aunt Saba. Saba, I don't know. Survivors themselves, as one doctor and nurse in charge of the concentration camp and infirmary, had managed to save the lives of innumerable inmates, including my mother and sister. After the war, they'd set up a medical practice in a small Catskill village where I discovered, to my amazement, they had one celebrity patient, Rav Moshe. My aunt mentioned casually that Rav Moshe had an appointment the next day. Would I like to meet him? Would I? It was like asking me, would I like to meet God? Okay? Well, how do? But but still pretty impressive. I couldn't sleep that night. I agonized over what I should wear. Should I approach him? What should I say? Should I mention that this son-in-law was my Rebbe? I guess Rav Tandler, I don't know. Should I speak to him in English or my rudimentary Yiddish? I was seated in the waiting room in the best clothing I had with me an hour before this appointment. It seemed like an eternity, but eventually he arrived, accompanied by an assistant at each side. He didn't notice me. I was frozen. I had intended to rise deferentially when he entered, but I didn't. I had prepared a few sentences that I had repeatedly memorized, but I sensed that my heart was beating too quickly for me to speak calmly. My aunt had heard the chime when he entered and came out of the office to greet him. Rabbi Feinstein, did you meet my nephew, Ike? Can you believe an unobservant like me has a yeshiva bachar in the family? Rav Moshe Feinstein looked at me. I was mortified. My aunt was addressing him irreverently. She was joking with him. She had called me Ike, not Yitzchak or even Isaac. Then it got even worse. She walked over to him. Surely she knew not to shake his hand. She didn't. She kissed him affectionately on the cheek, as she did many of her favorite patients. She then told him my uncle would see him in a minute and returned to the office. Rav Moshe and his attendants turned and looked at me, I thought, accusingly. I wanted to die. In a panic, I walked over to him and started to apologize profusely. Rabbi Feinstein, I apologize to my aunt. She isn't from. She doesn't understand. He immediately placed his fingers on my lips to stop me from talking. He then softly spoke two sentences in Yiddish that I will remember to my dying day. She has number on her arms. She's holier than me. Rav Moshe had understood what I had not. Our holiest generation was defined by the numbers on their arms. That was Rav Moshe. Unbelievable story. I've heard that from a bunch of people. And it's definitely indicative of who he was. Here is the eulogy, or I guess the obituary that they wrote after Rav Moshe passed away on Yud Gimel Adar next week, right before Purim, Tanis Esther, March 25th, 1986. You see it was late because it was Adar Beis, I think. More than 20,000 Orthodox Jews filled the blocks of Lower East Side yesterday to listen to sorrowful eulogies for Rav Moshe Feinstein, a towering scholar whose rulings guided the religious practice of millions of Jews around the world. Happens to be Rav Moshe was buried on Har Menuchos in Eretz Yisrael. Next to his Rebbe, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, but they had a whole procession here also. Rabbi Feinstein, a short, richly bearded, and well-groomed man. This is obviously written in the New York Times. This is not like in a Jewish publication. Russian-born Talmudic scholar who was recognized as perhaps the world's foremost posek, a widely respected rabbi who rules on practical application of age-old Jewish principles to modern circumstances. From the crucial to the trivial, can a couple seek to have a child through artificial insemination? Under what conditions may an observant Jew ride an elevator on the Sabbath, sometimes crucial, sometimes relatively trivial? These were among the thousands of questions on which rabbinical authorities around the world sought out Rav Moshe, as he was affectionately known, for a judgment. His answer was usually accepted as law. His stature as the giant of his generation was so legendary that it was often said that a young rabbi finishing his training needed two things: an ordination certificate and Rav Moshe Feinstein's telephone number. Unfortunately, I don't have it. His mystique was based on an intelligence and a command of halacha, or Jewish law, that other rabbinic scholars found awe-inspiring. He was said to have studied the 62 volumes of the Talmud, the rabbinic commentaries that constitute much of the Jewish law, more than 200 times, and was said to know many texts verbatim. Born near Minsk, rabbis were also struck by what they described as a remarkable humility. His phone number was listed, and he was available for calls from average followers of Orthodoxy as well as its authorities. In 1937, after a period of house arrest for religious activities, Rabbi Feinstein was brought out of Russia through international intervention, and he came to the United States. Jews looked to Rabbi Feinstein for guidance in dealing with new technologies and such medical areas as contraception and heart and organ transplants. On the question of riding elevators on the Sabbath, it was decided that elevators that could be programmed to stop at every floor and required no manual operation were permissible. The Shabbos elevator. On fertility, artificial insemination solely with the husband's sperm was approved under certain conditions. Starting in 1946, he published 7 volumes of the commentary on the Talmud called Dibros Moshe. Those were his shiurim from the Shiva. After 1959, 7 volumes of his responses to questions of halacha from rabbis around the world were published under the title Igros Moshe. At his death, Rabbi Feinstein was chairman of the Council of Sages of Agudas Yisrael, of America, an Orthodox communal group, and from 1966 to 1967, he was the president of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis in America and Canada. Surviving are his wife, Sima. There you go, there's Sima, two sons, Rabbi David of Manhattan, Rabbi Reuven of Staten Island, and two daughters, Faya Shiskal. Was it Faye? I don't know. She's called Manhattan and Sifra. There you go. Sifra Tendler of Muncie, New York. That's a little bit about Rav Moshe, even from a secular perspective, how much attention he got. Now, for the second part of the class. Yeah.
Joe Berger was a classmate of mine at Ron Collins.
Oh, yeah.
He had gone to
Yeshiva. No kidding. Good. You wrote for the New York Times, too.
Yeah. So did Clyde Haberman, who was a guy in Yeshiva with me.
Okay.
Went by the wayside.
Okay. So on the occasion of Rosh Chodesh Adar, I thought we'd share an idea from Rav Moshe about Purim. Rav Moshe's drashas are compiled in this sefer called Drash Moshe. It's not always an easy book to navigate because, you know, you have a lot of the drashas in the beginning on the parsha, and then you have a lot of drashas on occasions that happen throughout Rav Moshe's life. And then you have in the newer editions, you have in the back some other drashas on the parsha. So he says here on Purim, Shem Purim, Shenikva al Shem HaPur. Why do we call the Purim Purim? Because of the lottery, which was a pur. Right? That's how you call it, that's how you say lottery. Tzarech lahavin hatam bezeh. Dehashem, because the name, HaOmer Ikar Inyan HaChag, usually the name is indicative of the main aspect of the holiday. Right? Now, exactly how to, you know, apply it to other things, unclear. But that's what he says. Usually, the Ikar Inyan HaChag. V'zeh Eino Ikar. V'af Lo Tafel. Not only is the name poor, not the main part of the Purim holiday, or the Purim story, it's also not even the secondary aspect of the Purim holiday. The poor itself didn't do anything. The poor was just the unfortunate preamble to what the main part of the miracle was. V'tzarech Lomar. Shehalimud mizehu shelo yachshav ha'adam. A person should not think that kshenasan lo Hashem yisparach shefa bracha shekvar hu biyadeo. That when Hashem gives you something in life, He gives you a blessing of some kind, that you think you've got it made and you can never lose it. Ve'ein tzarech letshuas Hashem, and therefore you don't need Hashem anymore. You have a good parnasa, you have a good job, you have a good context, you have some good community, whatever it is. You should never take it for granted and think, okay, I don't need Hashem for that part of my life anymore. I need Hashem for other things, but not for that. You should never think such. El tzarech lahargish shekmo shetzarech litzpal Hashem isbara kodem shenasan. Just like you have to daven to Hashem before you get that unbelievable opportunity or that unbelievable resource. You also have to daven to Hashem after you have it. Because you still don't know what your lottery is going to say. So even though the original lottery went in his favor, afterwards it goes to the opposite. And that same thing that he got in his lottery, which was good, ended up being bad. El tovas hayehudim, but rather it was for the good of the Jews. Vizel ikar gadol be'emuna. This is a very important foundational principle in faith. Sheyesh lilmon michag zeh, from this holiday. V'lachein shem zeh na'os lo yoser me'akol. That's why the name poor, the name lottery, is that much more important, because we have to recognize that things are never set in stone. And any gift that Hashem has given, any bracha that we've gotten from Hashem, is not necessarily going to stay that way. And we always have to be very thankful and very appreciative, but also to daven and ask Hashem that this should continue. I always say that the end of Shemona Esrei, Sim Shalom, sounds like a request. But in many ways, it's the greatest form of flattery to Hashem. Hashem, Sim Shalom Tov Bracha. Give us peace. What does it mean, give us peace? Give us exactly what we have now. I want everything to not change. I love everything that I have in my life. So much so that I'm asking you, Sim Shalom, make it all be peaceful. Make sure nothing else disrupts or interrupts or breaks up what I have going. Right? It's basically saying to Hashem, we love what you've given us. Sim Shalom, Tova Avrecha. That's what Moshe is saying here. The poor is to teach you that the lottery can always happen. And even if you have, if it looks like it's one way, it could always change. We can always think and make sure that we appreciate what we have, and we ask Hashem to keep it that way. And we can learn that from Purim. And that's why the holiday is called Purim. And in our introduction, or in our preparation, I should say, to that holiday, we remember Moshe Feinstein, who passed away on the 13th of Adar on Dan Esther in 1986. And Mir Hashem, we should continue to learn from him and continue to apply halacha with newer technology that are coming out, with the guidance that he sort of set down for us in, here in America. Baruch Hashem, we now have a little bit better of an appreciation for who he was, where he came from, and what he's done for the Jewish people. So everyone should have a good night, and remember him on Tanis Esther. Okay, Shkaya.
You know that Rob Pendler was also a biologist.